Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
What does Hezbollah want? Why is Kenya getting involved in Haiti?
What can the world's biggest iceberg tell us?
The Inquiry. One big question.
Can we trust Google?
Four expert witnesses.
Time for our second expert witness.
And an answer.
What will be the solution?
Explore the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world with The Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is Discovery from the BBC World Service. I'm Jim Al-Khalili, and in my series, The Life Scientific, I get to talk to some of the extraordinary men and women who are trying to understand our world and make it a better place. And my guest today likes to solve real-world problems. You can use mathematics to model virtually anything, he says.
Naira Chamberlain is president of the Institute of Mathematics and its Applications and principal mathematical modeler for multinational engineering company SNC-Lavalin-Atkins. He specializes in complex engineering and industrial problems, creating mathematical models to describe a particular feature or process and then running simulations to better understand it and predict its behavior. Naira is one of just a handful of esteemed mathematicians featured in Britain's Book of Prominent People, Who's Who, and the first black mathematician. Since 2018, he's featured on the Black Power List, celebrating the UK's top 100 most influential people of African or African Caribbean heritage. When he first made the list, he was particularly proud to rank higher than Stormzy and Lewis Hamilton, though his motto for life does, in fact, come from his childhood sporting hero, Muhammad Ali. With a mathematical twist, of course. Float like a butterfly, sting like a mathematician. Naira Chamberlain, welcome to The Life Scientific.
Thank you very much indeed. It's good to be here.
So tell me, what did you mean by sting like a mathematician?
Well, when Muhammad Ali was at his prime, he used to have the saying, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. And I could actually relate to that, you know, like when I say a mathematician sees a problem, they go around the problem, they float like a butterfly, and then you sting like a bee. But I think that a mathematician can sting harder than a bee, so sting like a mathematician, that's what I say.
And Muhammad Ali was a hero of yours, was he, growing up?
Yeah, so growing up in the 1970s, I liked to, you know, with my father, watch the boxing. And Muhammad Ali, you know, he was so brilliant at what he was doing. But the thing that really got me was how confident he was in his talking before, after the match, and how would he predict, you know, the things that he would say, you know, I am the greatest. I thought, whoa, you know, it was just so, you know, inspiring to me, you know, growing up in the 1970s.
We're going to come back to your childhood later on, but tell me, how do you use mathematical models to solve real world problems? You know, what's their power?
Most people, when they think about mathematics, they think you get the numbers, you put it into an equation, and there's a result that comes out. But there are some problems that there's no formula there. So what we have to be is very creative, develop a logical argument to build a mathematical model, whether it be an equation or an algorithm, and then do a simulation to look at how that model behaves to do our prediction of the situation.
Okay, so can you give me an example?
A good example was the championship football season of 2018-2019. My local radio station in the West Midlands, the sports presenter wanted to know what was the probability of Aston Villa making the playoffs. And you had all of these Aston Villa fans saying 70%, 50%, 10%. And I thought, well, let me write a mathematical model and do a simulation. I did a simulation based on the probability of them winning, losing or drawing the next sequence of the games, and did a comparison to the other teams that were around in the championship at the time. And I sent the results into the radio station saying that they would finish in fifth place, they would get 76 points, and that they will play West Bromwich Albion in the playoff. And this is an 80% chance of all of this happening. And come end of May, what happened? They finished in fifth place, they got 76 points, and they ended up playing West Bromwich Albion. There you go, mathematics.
If you have a mathematical model to tell you exactly what's going to happen in football matches, you'd be a very rich man.
You could be, but with me, I'm just passionate about the mathematics.
As we're going to hear. You grew up in Birmingham, Naira Chamberlain, hence, I presume, the support of Aston Villa. When did your fascination with maths first begin?
Most of my friends were into Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, but I like picking up a calculator and pressing the buttons till it flashed at me, somehow pretending I was some sort of super mathematician. But when I went to school and spoke to my careers teacher, said, could I do something which involves mathematics? He said, Nora, somebody of your physique, you should become a boxer. So I went home, spoke to my parents, and they said this to me, said, you don't need anybody's permission to be a great mathematician.
Your parents obviously sounded far more sensible. Did they have any sort of mathematics background?
No, I mean, my dad worked in a car factory. My mum worked in a hospital. My parents are part of the Windrush generation, and they came from Jamaica. And they have a saying in Jamaica, Talawa, we may be small, but this is what we can do. You know, they say you don't need anybody's permission to be a great mathematician.
Did you believe them? Did they persuade you that you could be what you wanted to be at the time?
I mean, I was at the age where you value your teacher's opinion above your parents, do you know what I mean? So, you know, even though mathematics was my strongest subject, I found it fascinating. And, you know, I went on to do the equivalent of GCSEs, A-levels. I didn't really believe that I could really be an actual mathematician.
As you say, you did choose to do maths at A-level, and the statistics part, I believe, gave you a glimmer of hope that maths, not boxing, might provide a possible future for you.
Yeah, I mean, when I was doing my A-levels, I did a strange combination. I did mathematics, history and geography. Now, for geography, well, I had to go on, let's say, a geography field trip up in Cumbria, and one time to stand in the middle of a river and measure all of these balls and correlate it with the depth of the water to see how fast the flow of the balls were and collect all that data and then put it into a statistical model. And I'm thinking, actually, this is very interesting. This is actually using mathematics in a real-world sense as opposed to doing, you know, times table or pure algebra, was actually applying mathematics to the real world.
Well, in 1987, Nora Chamberlain, you went off to study mathematics at Coventry Polytechnic, now Coventry University. What was it like to finally be around other people who shared your interest in maths?
It was just an amazing time of mixing with people who would just love solving mathematical problems and would just bounce ideas off each other and write things on the blackboard and the whiteboard and would challenge our lecturers and say, give us harder problems. It was an amazing time of being a mathematician.
Your maths degree was a 4-year course because you spent your third year on a placement in industry at an RAF base in Cambridgeshire. And it was during this year that you developed your first mathematical model and wrote your own computer code. But before we get onto the model itself, tell me, what was it like working at the RAF base?
Well, I found it really exciting, and all my fellow students was asking me, oh, Nora, did you work on the Harrier or tornadoes? And I said, no. And they said, Nora, what were you doing? I said, oh, I was working on kitchens. And I said, kitchens? I said, yes, I was working on kitchens.
What was the real-world problem that they wanted you to solve?
You had these kitchens that actually serve 1,000 personnel, 2,000 personnel, and these kitchens were made up of cookers, refrigerators, pots, pans. But each of these items will have a certain lifetime, you know, where they will actually break down and they will actually replace. But the question when it comes to cost, you say, well, is there a more cost-effective way of doing, let's say, kitchen replacement? Should we just keep on this rolling replacement? Or after, let's say, every 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, should we just replace everything?
A lot of listeners will be thinking, yeah, I can get that. You think about the lifetime of the different appliances. But how do you go about turning that into maths?
So say for a cooker, you go out to get some data from the commercial, say this cooker's going to last 10 years exactly, but it's not going to do that. There's going to be some sort of variation. So we want to build in that uncertainty, that variation, into a mathematical model.
Well, you had to sort of plug into your simulations the lifetime of the different appliances.
Yeah, then major repair, minor repairs, and simulate that through time to actually say which strategy actually optimise the costs. With a kitchen that serviced, let's say, 1,000 personnel, we found that after 7 years, you replace everything, no matter how old or new it is.
Presumably that doesn't apply to sort of my kitchen at home.
No,
nor am I planning on feeding 1,000 people. So
I'm more than happy to do a simulation on your kitchen at home to tell you where you should replace that kitchen.
Well, after your degree, Nora, you went on to study for a master's in industrial mathematical modelling. This was at Loughborough University. But despite your interest in carrying on with your studies, you didn't then go on after that to do a PhD.
No.
Tell me why.
I did apply to do a PhD at Loughborough, but unfortunately I wasn't down selected to be the final candidate. So I decided actually just to go out in industry.
You went off and worked as an analyst for an engineering firm. This is in 1993. Tell me what sort of work that involved.
This was an automotive firm, so I was looking at things like piston dynamics and other car components and just running the simulations, but I hadn't really developed my own mathematical model. It was using somebody else's mathematical model to produce the results.
And after a few years, I believe, you moved on to an IT company where you ran into the same basic problem. You're using software developed by other people rather than developing your own mathematical models, writing your own code. Was that frustrating for you?
Yes, it was frustrating.
And yet you did manage to keep your passion for the purer form of mathematics alive, didn't you?
I was very much, using an analogy, a fan of mathematics rather than being a mathematician. Like, so, for instance, football fans, they like going to football stadiums and watching football players. With me, I love going to mathematical conferences and watching all of these mathematicians doing whatever they're doing on the whiteboard or on the blackboard and thinking, wow, you know, for instance, look at Marcus de Sautoy. He's doing all these things on the whiteboard and next minute he's pulling out a trumpet to demonstrate prime numbers. It was just seeing people doing the mathematics and they come up with a solution saying, hence it is proven, QED. Amazing. That is mathematics.
As an aside, I gather you also put your logical thinking skills to good use to gain an advantage against your workmates on Thursday night tenpin bowling.
Yes, I joined the tenpin bowling league and I was playing against semi-professionals and just observing them, I recognised that most tenpin bowlers are right-handed. So henceforth, they use the right-hand side of the lane and bowl the ball and the ball swings in and hits the king pin, which is the pin at the front, at the optimal position. But the thing is, the lane conditions gets degraded every time you run a ball down. And I've seen that not many people was actually using the left-hand side of the lane. So I'm thinking, could I use my right hand to roll the ball left to right, so I could use the left-hand side of the lane. And by doing some practice and developing the reverse swing, I became quite successful and I actually could compete with the semi-professionals at this tenpin bowling league, and I've won quite a number of trophies.
Let me take you back to these maths conferences, because there was one in particular, I believe, in 1999 that left a very strong impression on you.
Yeah, so I went to a conference in Edinburgh, the International Congress for Industrial and Applied Mathematicians, and the next minute I was surrounded by this group of African-Americans, and they said, we are the Congress of African-American Research Mathematicians. And then one of them came up to me and says, Naira, somebody of your enthusiasm and passion, you should really do a PhD, because there are historical reasons why there are not many black mathematicians that do a PhD in mathematics. So I was suitably inspired by this gentleman. So I decided to apply to do a PhD at one of the universities in Birmingham, and, you know, all excited, and went to the interview, you know, sat down with the professor, and professor looked at me and he says, Naira, you are technically weak and naive if you think you can do a PhD in mathematics.
But that must have been awful for you.
Yeah, it was challenging, because seeing as the professor would have been somebody almost like the type of people doing all these crazy things on the whiteboard that I would admire. But to me, it told me that this mathematics is only for certain people. It excluded me.
And what did your parents say when they heard about this?
Oh, they said to me, Naira, you don't need anybody's permission to be a great mathematician. And I said to them, Mom, Dad, out of total respect, Dad, you work in a car factory. Mom, you work in a hospital. Well, you got this professor of mathematics that says I can't do mathematics. You got a teacher said that I can't do mathematics. So that's it. I'm done.
What impact did this have on you?
I was still doing my day job, but I stopped attending mathematical conferences because this was the end of the road. This is it. You know, in effect, they were saying to me, you don't belong here.
Well, a few years later, Naira, in 2003, you started working as a mathematical modelling consultant at the Babcock International Group, which manages complex assets and infrastructure like transport and buildings for clients like the MOD, like Network Rail. And it was there that you got the chance not only to apply mathematical models created by others, as you had been doing, you also started to develop your own. Tell me what that was like.
I started to get my passion about mathematics back, and I was being a consultant, standing in front of a client and saying, tell me what your complex problem is, then you would actually turn into mathematics, and then you as the person, the spotlight was on. I found it quite exciting. I was thinking, well, yes, this is the mathematician I really wanted to be.
So what real-world problems were you writing these mathematical models for?
There was one problem that was to do with global IT hardware system. And the question was, how many engineers do you need around the world and where should they be located? And so I was looking at this, and I remember one time I went to, let's say, one of these conferences, and they was talking about the traveling salesman problem. Mm. You have a salesman and he has to visit all the 50 cities in the United States. What is the best route that that salesman should take to minimize the distance traveled? And so I was looking at this problem, and I'm thinking, well, it feels a bit like the traveling salesman problem, but it's a bit different. So I developed the traveling repairman, which was a variation on the traveling salesman problem. So instead of minimizing distance, what we tried to do is minimize time. And that was the algorithm that I used. And it ended up reducing the number of engineers needed by 50%. And it very much worked.
Around this time, people at the company started noticing your mathematical ability and offered to fund a PhD. But you stalled. Why was that?
You know, I still had what the professor had said to me a number of years ago. Mm. And then a year later came to my appraisal review. He says, we told you to start a PhD. Why haven't you? I said, well, I thought you was joking. I said, we really want you to do a PhD. We don't care what PhD is, as long as it is mathematics. So I said, well, thank you, no, thank you. But I still didn't do anything.
But eventually you did take them up on the offer. So what was the trigger?
The trigger was my son was 4 years old at the time. And he went to an infant junior school. And the teacher said to him, what would you like to be when you grow up? And my son said, oh, I would like to be a mathematician. And the teacher says, you will never be a mathematician, but you might grow up to become a singer. And when I heard this, I was really angry. I wanted to go to that school and give that teacher a piece of my mind. And then I thought, well, but wait a minute. What's happened to my son is exactly what's happened to me. What type of role model am I going to be to my son if he sees me not becoming a mathematician? So I thought, there is.
So in 2005, you began studying for your PhD part-time at Portsmouth University while continuing to work for the company. By now, Nara, you're in your mid-30s. How did it feel being a student again?
It felt amazing. You know, sometimes I'm a consultant speaking to directors, and then the next day I'm a student. They looked at me and they're thinking, well, you're 35, but you got such enthusiasm and passion. Yeah, we'll talk to you about mathematics.
So tell me about the maths. What was your PhD on?
The title of the PhD was called The Extension of the Gambler's Ruin Problem Played Over Networks.
Because the problem itself, the gambler's ruin problem, is very old, isn't it? It goes back to the 17th century.
Yeah, 1657 or something like that. But instead of having, let's say, the classical gambler's ruin problem, two players playing against each other, you play it over a network. And it's really about mathematical competition to see how entities compete against each other. It's not a model of gamblers per se, but how entities compete over a network. You just put in all these rules that mimic the rules of business, and you just sit back and just see what properties actually emerge.
And it sounds like you are finally now getting the chance to develop your mathematical creativity.
Yes, very much so. I was being creative at work, and I was being creative under the PhD. I was becoming the mathematician that I always wanted to be.
Now, alongside your PhD, I love this, in 2006, you got involved in this new project at work, HMS Queen Elizabeth, the largest aircraft carrier ever constructed for the Royal Navy, multi-billion pound project. I only saw it last week, just leaving Portsmouth Harbour, actually, because I live nearby. It is an impressive thing. And at the time, the ship hadn't yet been built. What did they want you to do?
When they were coming to the end of the scientific phase, you need to submit a business case to the MOD to say, this is what we believe that the ship will look like, this is how much it will cost to build, and this is how much it will cost to run. And a Royal Navy captain says, Nara, we've got this ship, it's too expensive to run. Is there a mathematical way of solving this problem? And I thought about it, and I said, okay, have you ever heard the story Goldilocks and the Three Bears? And he says, you what? I said, yeah, Goldilocks. She goes into the house. He sees the porridge and says, this porridge is too hot. This porridge is too cold. Or this porridge is just right. That's how you solve your problem. And he went away and he came back. He took me into this meeting and said, this is the meeting of us possibly cancelling this project. And we've heard that you've come up with a solution. And then I showed them an optimization algorithm that showed that if you actually changed the designs and the ability of the ship, you could actually run it at a cost which was affordable.
So what was it about the ship's design and capability that had to change to make it affordable?
There was a whole series of changes that we had to make. Shorter the length of time it's at sea, then that means that the number of supplies, you know, food, fuel, we can take less of that. Also, when it's at port, we have a longer turnaround time. It means you have more time to do repairs and resupply. And also, We have to change the reliability of the systems that are actually on the ship.
How then did you convince the Royal Navy to go with your adjustments predicted by your model? Presumably, you had to explain more than Goldilocks and the Three Bears to persuade them.
The nice thing about the model, and let me quote Einstein. Einstein says that mathematics is the poetry of logical ideas. Now, most people come in with these ideas, but the assumption was too close to the solution. But having this mathematical model, what we had is the assumptions very, very low down, and we built a logical argument towards a solution. So you will see a whole series of mathematical process to that solution. So people could actually see the argument that I was making. And I'm saying, we challenge that, change this. So that we could have this ongoing conversation. From that, it gave them confidence with the solutions.
Well, they did go with your calculations. So how did that make you feel?
When I saw the ship in 2008, I felt very, very proud. And especially when I heard that there's a placard of all the people that actually contributed to my name somewhere on the aircraft carrier, there's the name Dr. Nora Chamberlain. I'm a mathematician.
And your work, in fact, on HMS Queen Elizabeth did get noticed more widely as well, didn't it?
There was an American encyclopedia called the Encyclopedia of Mathematics and Society, and to my amazement, when I went to Section A, and there's a section there called Aircraft Carrier, it talks about Nora Chamberlain and the cost-capability trade-off model. It got picked up by some American mathematicians, so if I ever find that person, I have to thank them.
Well, during your 9 years at Babcock, you climbed the ranks, Nora Chamberlain, becoming the senior expert in mathematical modelling there, and all the while doing your PhD in your spare time, which you completed in 2014. That must have been a big moment for you.
Yeah, because doing a PhD part-time and working full-time, it was always challenging. And when they said to me, congratulations, you got the PhD, I had to pick up the phone to the internal examiner. I said, is the PhD really finished? And they said, yes, it's finished. I was thinking, I don't believe I got a PhD until I get that certificate that comes through the door. And then 3 weeks later, it was a very awesome time. Yeah.
It must have been. Well, despite all the knockbacks, you are now Dr. Chamberlain. That same year, you were listed by the Science Council as one of the UK's top 100 practicing scientists in recognition of the mathematical models you've developed for industry. And 6 months later, you were featured in Who's Who, the annual book of prominent people who've left their mark on British life. And that signalled a new chapter for you, I understand.
Yeah, because in terms of the Science Council, I mean, that happened, let's say, 3 days after I got the PhD. And then with the Who's Who, it was only when the book came out, somebody said to me, are you the first black mathematician to feature in the Who's Who? And I said, well, look, the Who's Who has been around since 1849. Surely there'll be another black mathematician there. And so I looked at the list of black mathematicians I thought would be there, and they weren't there. Since 1849, that makes me the first black mathematician to get into the Who's Who. And then I received a message from Professor Geoffy Fanken, the first black female mathematician to get a PhD in mathematical education in South Africa. And she said, being the first is nothing to be proud of, but it's according to ensure that one is not the last.
How did you feel about what she said?
I thought, oh, okay, there's like a responsibility here. Something's gone wrong. It was around about the same time as Hidden Figures, which was about three African-American female mathematicians that worked for NASA as computers.
That was a hugely successful Hollywood movie, wasn't it?
Yes. And it got me thinking, well, I know about these mathematicians. I was wondering whether there are any other black mathematicians, let's say Hidden Figures, whose stories haven't been told.
So what did you do about this?
October is Black History Month, and I'll go to a number of Black History Month events just to see whether I could find out about black mathematicians. But every time I was going to these events, I kept on finding, you know, Beyonce, you know, the one that sings, you know,
That's exactly, it's like I'm listening to her now.
And I was thinking, well, wait a minute, I'm not seeing nothing about black mathematicians, black scientists, black engineers. And what an organisation said to me, we don't know about black mathematicians, Myra, but you're a mathematician. You tell us about black mathematicians and we'll feature about it. So I did some research and created a social media poster called The Black Heroes of Mathematics.
So who did you find? These are mathematicians who are still active today?
The mathematicians that I had on the original poster was historical mathematicians. A modern-day example is Dr. Angela Tabari, and she developed a network of female mathematicians to transform the continent of Africa through mathematics. So these are, let's say, hidden figure mathematicians out there added to the field of mathematics.
And hopefully examples for the next generation. But, you know, how popular, then, is maths among African Caribbean populations in the UK?
It is very challenging. One of the things that we are doing through the Institute of Mathematics and Application is that we put on a conference called the Black Heroes of Mathematics, where we showcase black role models who contribute to the field of mathematics, and we have black mathematicians from all around the world.
There's a pool of talent there that we're missing out on, but of course it's not equal opportunities. You want to strengthen that opportunity, I understand. For example, you talk to children through the Speakers in Schools charity to try and inspire them about mathematics.
Yes, I want to do this again and again about how we use, let's say, mathematics in the real world, and also to get over the message about my story that you don't need anybody's permission to be a great mathematician, and that mathematics is for everybody.
And of course, you are pretty good at public speaking from what I've seen. Does that come naturally to you?
I enjoy talking about mathematics, and I talk about mathematics in a very enthusiastic and passionate way. But my wife, Jacqueline, who's an English teacher, she would come to my talk and she would watch me and listen to me and she would pick me up on my diction. But she's she's my number one fan, and I very much have improved because of her.
And I also believe you've got a cupboard full of mathematically inspired clothing too.
Yes, I have a hoodie, I have ties. One time I got this jumper. I was walking through a shop one time and the jumper was just saying, buy me, and it's got Fermat spiral on it.
Do you always check that the maths on these items of clothing is actually correct?
I do now. I remember one time I had a T-shirt and somebody pointed out that formula's wrong, but sometimes you get onto the other end where I had the wrong Riemann formula on it, and I had these mathematicians coming up to me almost using me as like a living whiteboard and thinking, no, you're not going to do that.
Now, as I said at the start, since 2018, you've been on the Black Power list of the 100 most influential people of African or African Caribbean heritage in the UK. How did that come about?
I was at Bangkok, and Nari, you've done all these things and we think that you're good enough to get onto the power list, you know, and then I thought that if I'm making it in the top 100, you know, I'll be happy with that. And I was really surprised when I found out I was in the top five ahead of Stormzy and Lewis Hamilton. I thought, whoa. But the following year, they said to me, so Nara, have you made another aircraft carrier? And I said, what? I'm thinking you were talking about one in a generation. So they're now in the top 100. But one year, I was actually one place below Meghan Markle, so I can't complain.
What an incredible journey you've had. Tell me, what's your message to youngsters today who enjoy maths in the same way that you did as a boy?
Don't want to sound repetitive, but you don't need anybody's permission to be a great mathematician.
And what about your son? Did he ignore his teacher's advice and follow in his father's footsteps?
Yes, I mean, he's a 3D games modeller. And so when he shows me all the stuff that he's doing, drawing all this surface and look like finer element.
He's doing mathematical modelling as well then?
Sort of mathematical modelling. If I say to him, this is mathematics, he says, no, it's not. And I said, yes, it is, but I'm very proud of him.
Nara Chamberlain, thank you very much for sharing your life scientific.
Thank you very much indeed.
And thank you for listening. And thanks to my producer, Beth Eastwood. You can listen to other episodes in the series at bbcworldservice.com/discovery.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news. With insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many US voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the US election, search for The Global Story, the documentary, and The Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.